info@wpfw.org.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Why would the son of one of history's most liberal icons throw his support behind the right-wing convicted felon Donald Trump? Rick Pallas has one backstory behind the RFK Jr. Trump endorsement. And later, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. Author Larry Tye says these three jazz men transformed America, and it wasn't only about their music. And good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, when RFK Jr., the son of one of the most liberal icons in American history, suspended his campaign for presidency and threw his support behind former President Donald Trump, millions of Americans were stunned, and the Kennedy clan immediately denounced him. All eight of his siblings signed a letter saying, quote, his decision to endorse Trump is a betrayal of the values that our father and our family hold most dear. Even RFK Jr.'s wife, actress Cheryl Hines, a lifelong Democrat, according to Kennedy, is the opposite of encouraging, quote unquote. Greg Pallas, the New York Times bestselling author and filmmaker, is a longtime friend and colleague of Kennedy Jr., and he has some backstory information that he believes may shed some light on Kennedy's shocking behavior. Shocking to some, perhaps not to all. Greg Pallas is the author of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits and The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and his latest film titled Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, available for download on September 13th, and a free download, that is, and a frequent guest here on Pacifica Radio and What's at Stake over the years. Welcome back, Greg Pallas. Thank you for joining
us. I'm always thrilled to be with you, except that I will correct you on the name of the film, which is Vigilantes, Inc., America's New Vote Suppression Hitman. And that will be available at gregpallas.com for gratis. You don't have to pay for it.
Okay.
September 13th.
Everybody will look forward to that.
You can sign up to get it for free now.
And that's going to discuss or reveal or expose, I'm sure, some of the shenanigans that are taking place.
We have real problems with our democracy. And we're going to be, and we'll be discussing that in the film, this whole new thing of vigilante vote challengers who are taking on. What they're doing is that we've already had several thousand self-appointed vigilantes in some states like Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, and others who are challenging the right of individuals to vote. And you'd be shocked to learn that almost all the people that they are challenging are non-white voters.
I'm not really shocked to learn that. Okay. So Greg, how would you describe your relationship with RFK Jr.? Were you strictly colleagues? I know you all have worked on a number of projects over the years. Or would you say you were confidants? How would you describe that relationship?
I don't know about confidants, but certainly I like to think of him he was a good friend. And I co-authored with him, like in the book Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, which hit the New York Times bestseller list. That book includes a chapter by Bobby, the introduction from him. I did top selling comic book, single issue adult comic book, or graphic book, as they call it, of all times. He was a co-author on that comic book. And he and I co-authored several stories for Rolling Stone together. We've done several things together. So over the years, we became quite close. Unfortunately, you see the article. There's an article at gregpallas.com called "I Was on the Phone with RFK."
Mm-hmm.
Lost his mind. And he just started falling apart in front of my eyes mentally.
Okay.
And I had to cut it off.
I want to get into that in a minute, but what was your reaction to his endorsement of Donald Trump? Did you see that coming? I mean, you wrote in an article that you had witnessed some unusual behavior on this part. Were you completely surprised, or you saw this coming?
No, that's why I had, look, I can have differences with people over their politics. That's one thing. But this is not a disagreement over politics. This is a guy who is mentally unstable. And I don't, to say that about someone, my co-author, someone I've worked with and known, is not something I like to reveal. It makes me actually quite uncomfortable having to talk about it and certainly having to write about it. But you cannot jeopardize the nation. You cannot take America down your mental rabbit hole. And that's what I'm concerned about, is that he would influence the election while he himself is not stable.
Well, now you were about to tell us about this phone conversation. You said you were on the phone with him when he lost his mind. Tell us, what is that about?
Well, actually, this was, obviously he didn't snap in a moment, but it's what happened. We were supposed to have it's about 10 years ago, he was supposed to have a press conference about the Deepwater Horizon. Just, you know, he's a big major environmentalist, which also makes the Trump endorsement quite strange. But we had done some work together, and we were supposed to hold a press conference about my investigation of the Deepwater Horizon. Turns out that before we had the Gulf explosion, just 17 months earlier, they had an identical explosion. A BP rig blew up in the Gulf, in the Caspian Sea, before the Deepwater Horizon blew out. And a BP, British Petroleum, and its partners, Chevron, Exxon, had covered up the prior explosion. So I did a big story for British television, and even wrote a book about it called The Vulture's Picnic, about that investigation and others. Bobby had talked to me about this on the air. He had his radio show Ring of Fire, and so he was back on the air, and he and I talked about the Deepwater Horizon and the fraud committed by he reviewed the book. He talked to me about it for an hour
on the air.
And I actually did for Democracy Now!, I did a segment with him on the Deepwater Horizon and for BBC television. So in other words, he was quite involved in this investigation. And on this phone call, he couldn't remember anything about the investigation. He couldn't remember that I ever spoke to him about it. You have to understand, I mean, we were just like now. We were literally on the air for an hour together talking about this. And this was one more example. He'd been losing it all along. This is one more example. And this got so crazy. Like, why couldn't he remember any of this? And my wife kept just giving me cutoff signals, like, cut it off. You got to stop talking to him because he's crazy. And finally just said, this was the last straw. He's lost his mind. And this is a terrible thing to say over the air. But, you know, you can't take your nervous breakdown with you. So she just said, look, we have to disconnect from this guy because he's going to blow up publicly at some point. He's going to blow, his crazy is going to blow up in public, and I'll be standing next to him and I'll get blown up with him. I think it would take the form of running for president.
Now, a number of people started to sort of write him off when he took a very controversial anti-vaxxer position. Was that one of the first signs for you?
Well, we had a disagreement over it. People can, you know, you want to vote for Trump, vote for Trump. You don't want to have a vaccine, don't have a vaccine. That's up to you. I'll disagree with you. But you can have disagreements. But what was happening is that he's a contrarian, as I've written, which is that one thing I like about him, he doesn't like the official story, whatever the official story is, whether it's on COVID or anything else. In many ways, that's good to be skeptical, but basically make made him susceptible to picking up every conspiracy theory. If he's getting any, if he's being accused of, you know, of accepting conspiracy theories, he grabs onto more. So that's what happened with Vax. He had been in the film and was involved in the promotion of the film Vaxxed, which raised some real serious and reasonable questions about the MMR vaccine, which used had mercury in it, and he was against the. He thought it was a bad idea to have kids vaccinated with mercury, little babies. And in the end, the big pharma backed off and they removed the mercury from the MMR vaccine. So that was a worthy cause. He took it on, but the big pharma went after him, completely decided to ruin him. They really went after him. And he stood up to big pharma, which is courageous. But then he got to the point where his reaction to being attacked was to say that virtually every vaccine is going to kill you or your children. And so he went, because he was under attack by big pharma, he reacted by going off the deep end the other way. So I kind of looked away at that. But like I say, it was the Looney Tunes aspect. And then, look, one of the blunt things and sad things is that his wife committed suicide. He spoke to him on the phone, and just after that, hung herself. It was horrific. And he was being blamed by the New York tabloids that for killing his wife, forcing her to commit suicide.
Why? Why would he be blamed for that?
I don't know. You have to ask the New York Post. And, you know, so they went after him on that. He saw his father murdered on television. The guy's had a lot of psychological.
You say he's mentally unstable.
Yes.
Did you attempt to contact his family at all after that conversation where he had no recollection whatsoever about the interview that you all had done on the radio?
I'll be honest with you. It was kind of scary, and I figured, well, you know, it's not my job to be his psychologist. So I didn't contact the family. Obviously, if they had to know that this was going on. It's inconceivable that they didn't know that there were problems. But of course, he wasn't running for president. if someone has mental illness problems, that's one thing. But you can't, you know, ask America to join your nervous breakdown.
So he was running for president at that time?
Not at that time. Actually, the irony is, for example, when Hillary was running. Was running for president, and most progressives were backing Bernie Sanders. He could have won if he had run at that time. No, who the heck, you know? And then there's Barack Obama. I mean, who the heck is Barack Obama? No one had ever heard of this guy. And if Kennedy, with that magical name and his tremendous speaking abilities, and by the way, Bobby is one of the most brilliant people I've ever met in my life. Oh my God, so. I'm not saying he's stupid or foolish by any means. He's brilliant. It's just that he could have been president if he'd have run, back in 2008. I have no doubt about it.
Okay, so you think the family? So this, you think this was probably dementia? Early onset dementia, Alzheimer's.
Well, we do know that, it was Bobby himself who announced it. They found a worm in his brain, and literally an actual worm got into his skull somehow and was eating at his brain. And this is from Kennedy himself, so this is not like gossip rumor.
So what was done about that?
What was done about that? Apparently, the worm ultimately died. I have no idea what procedure that they used to remove it. But the problem was this worm was literally physically eating his brain. And it's a horrible thing to even think about. But again, the only reason I said anything about this and about his mental condition is that he, you know, he's running for president, and then he decides to choose our president, that is Trump. And I can tell you, he thought Trump was, in working with him, he thought Trump was a monster. And so, you know, this kind of, that's the other thing, this craven behavior just to stay in the limelight suddenly, it just made no sense.
Well, apparently Kennedy was courted by the Trump campaign during Trump's first run for the presidency. According to Kennedy himself, Trump offered him an assignment to become the chair of a commission on vaccine safety and scientific integrity, which he accepted, but it never materialized. About 2 weeks ago, when Kennedy suspended his campaign and threw his support behind Donald Trump, he said, quote, "This time he's choosing to believe the former president would deliver." And that was apparently a reference to the unfulfilled promise made in 2017. So it really shouldn't be that surprising to anyone who's followed our RFK Jr. In recent years that he is throwing his support behind Trump.
Well, no, I don't. First of all, let's go back to this whole issue. Bobby is a lawyer, so he should know. RFK should know darn well that you cannot trade a position in the federal government for an endorsement. That's considered bribery. It's just, if I offer you something in return for an endorsement, you can't do that. That's illegal any more than Trump could say, well, I'll give you $1 million for your endorsement. You can't hand out a federal post in return for an endorsement.
It's not done all the time in politics.
What they did was completely and utterly illegal.
Okay. So let's go back to the worm. You say that's in his brain. You said Bobby made this announcement himself. And so family members are aware of that. And you think that maybe some sort of medical treatment was sought to.
Apparently, obviously he didn't diagnose the worm himself. Doctors found it, and this is actually quite recent, by the way. But it was before I wrote the article, and I just said, you know, this is getting, you know, I think it's a combination of things. Like I said, the man has had many. I would not want to trade with him. He watched his father shot on TV. His wife committed suicide, and he's blamed for it. He had a worm in the brain. All these things happening, and there's a lot of mental pressure on any person. So, like I say, I was actually even reluctant to talk about it because he's a friend, or was a friend. I'm sure he's not a friend now, but of course he's so over the edge. I don't want to.
So, have you done any recent projects with him?
No, because it just was too dangerous, literally. And you know, I kept this to myself. Like, why aren't you still writing with Bobby Kennedy? And I don't want to say, oh well, you know, my friend's lost his mind. But you know, now I have no choice. The nation's at stake, and this kind of, you know, the funny thing was he was never a media hound, because he'd been grown up as a Kennedy with cameras on him all the time, and he never sought out big publicity. And suddenly it's almost like he has this Trumpian thing where he can't give up the limelight. He has to get me. And, you know, I think it'd be very dangerous for him to have any position in the federal government. But of course, who knows whom else Trump will hand us.
Well, do you think that his throwing his support behind Donald Trump is going to help Trump to win the election? Do you think he has enough followers, enough support for that to happen?
It's down to the wire. that's why I've been doing, that's why the film Vigilantes Inc. Biden only won by about 44,000 votes in three states. That was it. Out of 189, about 180 some million votes cast, came out to 44,000. Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, etc. But so any type of any, if he can bring over even, you know, 1% of his followers, that could change the outcome of the election. So he doesn't need to have a giant following people that will follow him. And of course, you know, because, you know, he's getting a lot of attention. I mean, this is getting a lot of attention. There's no question about it.
It's got that magical Kennedy name, as you say. So he says it's the Democratic Party that has betrayed the values it once held, stating, quote, "It departed from the core values I grew up with. It has become the party of war, censorship, corruption, big pharma, big tech, and big money," end quote. And that's his justification or rationalizing for why he has switched from Democrat to Republican.
How weird is that? Think about that a minute. He's basically saying, and you can't say he's wrong. This is a very, by the way, this is a very Bobby technique, which when we were together was useful for us, but now it's a little bit obnoxious. It's not news that the Democratic Party, that there's corporate control in the Democratic Party. You know, he's right, big tech, big pharma, you name it. But what about the GOP? What about, what about Donald Trump? I mean, this is the guy who's, and look at his lineup of money and where it's coming from, Peter Thiel and, you know, the massive amount of money. The uber right wing Mellon family gave Trump $50 million from uber right wing freaks. And you have a massive corporate control. I mean, look, I think the best way to think about it is that, yes, corporations can rent Democrats, but they own the Republicans. I'm not being partisan about this. I'm a journalist and I'm just telling you how it works. Mm-hmm. So the idea that somehow he's gone from this dirty Democratic Party, which has corporate influence, to this clean, wonderful, corporate free Republican Party. Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It does seem a bit ironic. Kennedy said, of course, that he was choosing to believe the former president would deliver his reference, the unfulfilled promise, and you said that's illegal to appoint him as chair of a commission on vaccine safety.
Yeah, you can't bargain federal posts in return for a political endorsement.
I guess it's done all the time, but it's kind of like not spoken.
There's about a lot of wink and nod and going on, but literally Bobby was trying to get, by the way, he was also trying to get the Democratic Party to see if they would counter offer. Like, he put himself out for bid. Mm-hmm. And again, he said he didn't even get a recall back from the Democratic Party, of course, because he's basically saying, let's commit a crime together. I think they were too smart to call him back.
Trump, who had previously referred to Kennedy as a radical left lunatic, a wasted protest vote, now he's praising Kennedy as a beloved person, respected by everybody, but didn't comment on an appointment. And as for Kennedy, in the past, he branded Trump as a sociopath, a terrible human being. Now he's working to get him elected president.
Exactly. Both of them having this consistent, I know that people may have been shocked that Donald Trump suddenly reversed himself. The bigger shock to me is to see Kennedy play this game where he's trying to get the two parties to bid for his endorsement. It was actually quite, I mean, it's one of the things that threw me off too, that made me feel like I've got to absolutely go public. And that's why my article, you know, at Greg Palast, which you can still get at gregpalast.com, which is, you know, I was on the phone with RFK Jr. when he lost his mind. It was a hard thing to do, but I had to.
So any final thoughts on that, Greg Palast, our favorite intrepid reporter here on WPFW and What's at Stake?
Well, there's a lot at stake. I'm glad you had me on for it. There's a lot at stake. And one of the things I'm very concerned about is what's happening with our nation, this type of division. It's not whether I agree with Bobby or not, whether he is nuts or not. The decay of American politics is very concerning. And one of the things I'm very concerned about is when you have unstable people leading things, what I fear now is violence in American selection. So you know, it may seem like going from Bobby Kennedy with a worm in his brain to, you know, potential civil war in America after November 5. I mean, if Trump doesn't win, what I'd really like to know from Bobby is, would you be a peacemaker or a peace destroyer if Trump doesn't win on November 5? I'm very concerned about what we saw, the so-called insurrection of January 6th. That was just, that's nothing compared to what can happen this time.
You say so-called insurrection. You don't believe it was an insurrection?
We had people die. It was a serious business. It was definitely, you could definitely call it a riot. But a planned insurrection to overthrow the government, you ain't seen nothing yet, because on what's happened now is that the January 6th so-called, and again, I call it a so-called insurrection because I don't think that, but they wanted Vice President Mike Pence not to certify the results of the election. What I think is going to, if you go to gregpalast.com again, see something I call the quiet coup, in which in state after state, in Georgia, in Arizona, in North Carolina, and other states, states are now giving themselves the power not to certify the election. And if you don't certify the election in the states, that's far more serious than what they wanted Mike Pence to do. And we could see it that in states like Georgia, we may end up where they say we're not going to certify the votes out of Atlanta. So we're going to see, it won't be in Washington, D.C. The fight will be in each of the states. And if you don't certify the vote in a couple of states, you end up with the political manipulation that they want to accomplish with Mike Pence will now be at the state level. And that's what I really fear, is non-certification of the vote. I know it sounds a pretty dry term, but actually it means that they refuse, that you're going to see some Republican election officials like secretaries of state say, we are not going to certify the vote for our state, disenfranchising. Actually disenfranchising everyone. If Georgia and Arizona, for example, in 2020 had not certified their results, Trump would have been elected. And in fact, one of the Georgia voting officials said about 3 weeks ago that they would have not certified, the new right-wing Georgia State Elections Board would not have certified the election results of 2020. They would have ignored Atlanta. In other words, the Georgia vote would exclude one of the most significant African-American communities in the USA. They would have been excluded from the vote, and we'd all been disenfranchised. I know it sounds disenfranchisement certification sounds all dry, but this can determine the presidency.
Excuse me. Georgia was very significant in winning that election.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, this is why, infamously, Donald Trump called up the Secretary of State and said, find me 11,780 votes. Mm-hmm. Make him the winner. Well, the Secretary of State, even though who I know is actually a Republican who's very ultra right wing, and the governor is actually, Brian Kemp, is actually to the right of Donald Trump on basically every issue. But however, what they wouldn't do is go to prison for him. Remember, Trump has been indicted for this. He's facing major felony charges. And so the governor and secretary of state said no, because it would violate Georgia law. They didn't want to go to prison. But now they've actually changed the Georgia law so that now the governor, through his state board of elections, can in fact reverse that vote. And it's a dangerous new trend. And that's one of the things we put in the film in Vigilante Dink, which we are trying to get people to understand that this threat of not accepting the election results in a state can overturn the election in the way that Trump dreamed of. And I'm very, very concerned about that, about the non-certification of the vote. But I'm also very, very concerned about the idea that that obviously we're going to end up with the violence we saw in Washington, but we're going to see it in 30 states.
Wow. Yeah. Greg Palast, thank you so much. And we look forward to that film. Give us the name again, Vigilante.
Okay, the name of the film is Vigilantes, Inc. And it was narrated by Rosario Dawson, produced by Martin Sheen, my favorite president, President Bartlett. So you can go to gregpalast.com, sign up to get it for free. It will be released on September 13th.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on What's at Stake, Greg Palast.
You're welcome.
Of course, the question of the day is, how much impact will RFK Jr.'s support for Trump help him on Election Day? According to an article in Independent, ever since Vice President Kamala Harris entered the race, Kennedy lost a sizable amount of momentum from 8.5 to 10% down to 5% and dropping. It's impossible to predict if the independents will return to their party allegiances or switch, but according to a YouGov Economist poll taken since the Democratic National Convention, only 1% of Democrats say they'll vote for Trump, but 3% of Republicans will vote for him. In an election as close as the 2024 election pretends to be, every single vote will count, especially in the swing states. And Kennedy has his strongest support in the swing states of New Mexico, Florida, Michigan, Nevada. Again, Greg Palast, thank you for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake. Up next, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie, Jasmine Who Transformed America. Author Larry Tye will explain what could be dubbed their invisible activism. Back in a moment. Stay with us.
We'll
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, our next guest, Larry Tye, is a New York Times bestselling author of Bobby Kennedy and Satchel. His other books include Demagogue, Superman, and Rising from the Rails. Previously, he was an award-winning reporter at the Boston Globe and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. This morning, he's going to introduce us to his book titled The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Good morning, Larry Tye, and welcome to What's at Stake. Can you hear me, Larry?
I can. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, now we can. That's just fine. Great. Okay. So let me start by asking, are you a musician, a wannabe musician, a lover of jazz? Did you cover stories about musicians during your journalism career? What prompted Larry Tye to write a book about jazz men and uniquely about how they transformed America?
So I know pathetically little about music, although I love jazz. But what prompted me to write this book, if I had a minute to tell a story, I'd like to take you back 20 years ago when I wrote a book about the Black men who worked on the railroads called Pullman Porters. And these were, from the end of the Civil War until the 1960s, the best job a Black man in America could get was riding George Pullman's sleeping cars, because they got to see the country, they made more money than any Black men during that era. And most importantly, they got to ride with the likes of Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. Mm-hmm. And when these three jazzmen went south in that era of Jim Crow segregation laws, when they went south, if they tried to get a meal at the wrong restaurant or tried to book a room in a whites-only hotel, they could be anything from berated to beaten. So it was really dangerous for them. And what they did when they could afford it, and they could afford it for much of their career, was they would hire private Pullman sleeping cars to go south with them. And so if they were doing a concert in a city like Atlanta, after they finished their performance, they knew that they had a warm and delicious meal waiting for them at their Pullman car. They had a bed that was made by the best bed makers in the world, who were the Pullman Porters. And most importantly, they had a safe haven. And what they did in return for that measure of safety is, in the middle of the night, in the closed capsule of their railroad car, the Duke Ellington Orchestra would play a private concert just for the Pullman Porters. And Verna, I don't know about you, but if I could go back to any moment in history, it would be pretty darn nice to have Duke Ellington or Louis Armstrong performing just for me.
I'd have to agree with you wholeheartedly on that, Larry. What a unique experience. But what does that have to do with your writing this book?
So what it has to do, I'm glad you asked me, because what it has to do is, when the Pullman Porters made me promise that when I got done writing about them, that I would write a book on the three favorite passengers, who were named Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie. And the reason they were their favorites was because, not just for their music, but the Pullman Porters were smart enough to have recognized something that I didn't recognize, which is that these jazz men set the table for the civil rights movement in America. And so, partly to keep my promise to the Pullman Porters, and partly because I thought there was a half of these musicians' legacy that the world didn't know about, I spent the last 3 years digging into the music, but more importantly, the lives off their bandstand of these three jazz luminaries.
So, you know, Larry, there's a part in the preface of your book that struck me. It basically kind of articulates what you're attempting, or I think has very eloquently proven in this book. It's the last paragraph on the first page. It states quite eloquently what these three jazzmen were able to accomplish. Can you please read that for us? It starts at the last paragraph, starting with, "Each defied and ultimately overcame racial boundaries."
So on the last paragraph.
On the first page.
Each defied and ultimately overcame racial boundaries, not by waging war over every slight, which would have accomplished little in that Jim Crow era, but by opening America's ears and souls to the magnificence of their melodies. And then I tell a story that, while I can't prove it, I think this is what was going on across America, that white men who would never have allowed a Black to cross their threshold in the privacy of their own listening habits wooed their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Louis Armstrong and the extraordinary Duke Ellington. And as important, Verna, white women who, if a Black man were walking towards them on the sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. When they got home, they kicked off their high heels and they turned on the toe-tapping music of the Count Basie Orchestra. And I want to say that if your toes didn't tap when you were listening to Count Basie, they used to say you ought to go visit a doctor because something had to be anatomically wrong with you. But the point is that for once, race fell away and people just listened rapt to this music. And I think that was the infiltration, the quiet infiltration of the revolutionary ideas that Black men like Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie could be geniuses. And lo and behold, the sky wouldn't fall if we gave them equal rights. But the fact that I wrote this doesn't matter. What matters is that Martin Luther King Jr., in a little notice speech that he delivered in Berlin in the early 1960s, he said precisely the same thing. He said, if not for these jazz men, then the work that he and the civil rights pioneers were doing would have been twice as hard, because they had opened America's minds and ears to the idea that Black men could be geniuses.
Wow. And so in your book, you really get personal. You introduce us to these individuals in a way that has never been done before, to my knowledge. Is it true that Louis Armstrong fudged his birth date, was raised by a Jewish family, and learned to play the horn in reform school?
All of those, I think, are true. What is true is that at age 13, on a New Year's Eve, when he was for fun firing his stepfather's gun into the air, he was grabbed by a policeman and thrown into jail and ultimately sent to reform school. And Lewis used to say that had he not gone to reform school, he would have ended up like too many of his friends who didn't make it beyond their teenage years. And instead, in reform school, he learned how to play a bugle and then a cornet and then his world famous trumpet. And that is what gave him a start in life. He was raised by a Jewish family in the sense that he was hired by a family of immigrants named Karnofsky, who had a rag wagon. They would sell rags on the streets of New Orleans. And they were smart enough to know that if they had somebody tooting a horn, it would make their rag wagon stand out from all the other ones there. They hired young Lewis to blow a horn that they gave him, and they took him home with them many a night, gave him a warm meal, sang Jewish lullabies to him, and for the rest of his life, he honored this family by wearing around his neck a Star of David. And it is true that Louis Armstrong went from these rough streets of New Orleans in a neighborhood so rough and tumble that it was known as the battlefield. And he became a man who would have been famous if it were only for his trumpet, but he had a voice that was equally famous. And his voice was so famous in Chicago in his early days of performing that young kids would stick their head out of the car window in the middle of winter to try to catch cold so they could sound like the raspy Louis Armstrong.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk Duke Ellington, the person that's dear to our listeners here. How did Duke Ellington get his nickname, and what does it tell us about his royal bearing and self-satisfaction?
So unlike Armstrong, who grew up in the rough streets with no money and with a single mother who was working hard to put food on their table, Duke Ellington grew up in the largest middle-class Black community in America, in Washington, D.C., and he grew up in a house that had a steep staircase. And every morning when he was a kid, on his way to school, he'd walk down those stairs and he would tell his young nephews at the bottom of the stairs, "You should bow to me." He told his young nieces, "You should curtsy." And he told all the adults at the bottom of the stairs, "Applaud, applaud, because someday the world is going to know me as the great and the grand Duke Ellington." And he used to tell lots of stories on where he got his nickname. But I will tell you, don't believe any of them. He dubbed himself Duke. He proved worthy of the aristocratic title. And from almost moment one, he was magic. He was magic in composing 6,000 songs. He was magic in being an amazing arranger. He played a piano as well as anybody in the world. And he was most known of all for being a band leader. And for any one of those five things, he would have been a star, but he was the ultimate Duke because he did them all and he did them all well.
Sounds like he knew from the very beginning what he was destined for. Well, here at WPFW, we know and appreciate the power of jazz. Duke Ellington's A-Train actually ushered WPFW onto the airways in 1977. Our founders were adamant about jazz being the foundation of our music programming, but it's my belief that jazz speaks to different communities differently, Larry. A Black community is going to hear and relate to a jazz piece differently than a white, a Native, Hispanic, or Asian community, but all will have a visceral connection to the music. What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts about that are A, that you're exactly right, and B, one of the amazing things about these three guys, aside from them all having been born within 5 years of one another at the turn of the century, what united them was that they all had careers that lasted at the top of the heap for a full half century. Now, Verna, I don't know about you, but the idea of today, anybody staying popular for 50 long years is almost inconceivable. And they did it exactly by what you were suggesting. They reached across audiences. They had extraordinary viewership and fanship and listenership in the Black community. They did the same in the white world, selling millions of records and making themselves rich. They reached across to a Hispanic world, to a Native American world. There was something universal and about humanity itself in their music that touched everyone. And there aren't many people who can do that, touch as many audiences in as different and compelling ways as these three guys did.
So I get the impression that you feel as though it wasn't just the music that contributed to their having helped to transform America. It was something in their personalities as well. One was considered an Uncle Tom. Which one was that?
That was sadly Louis Armstrong. And this guy who grew up in a Jim Crow world and managed to succeed the way he did, it absolutely was eating away at him that he was called an Uncle Tom. And he finally burst forward in 1957, when a young reporter came to interview him at his hotel room. The reporter said the most stunning civil rights development in 1957 was nine Black kids being told by a federal judge that they would integrate the all-white Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. And there was a racist governor in Arkansas named Orville Faubus, who essentially said, "You will integrate this school over my dead body." And the reporter said to Louis Armstrong, "What do you think about that? We've got a racist governor. These poor kids are getting no protection from the federal government when they're trying to integrate this school." And Louis Armstrong let loose. He called the governor a word that begins with M and ends with R and has mother in the middle of it that I won't say on your airwaves.
Thank
and
you.
And that became translated in a family newspaper to an uneducated plowboy. He called our war hero president, Dwight Eisenhower, a gutless so-and-so. And he took off. And the press the next day couldn't believe it. This guy who they thought was an Uncle Tom was suddenly taking off against a governor and the president. But the one person who listened to him more than anybody else was that US president, Dwight Eisenhower, who loved Louis Armstrong. And I don't think it was a coincidence that shortly after Armstrong's tirade, Dwight Eisenhower sent in the federal troops to protect those kids who had become known as the Little Rock Nine, so that they could at least have their safety insured when they were taking the courageous step of integrating that high school.
That's a compelling story. Go ahead.
So Louis Armstrong was anything but an Uncle Tom, but too much of America didn't see it because he would ham it up when he went on television. He had his handkerchiefs, he would play to white audiences, and he never saw a contradiction between being an entertainer and an artist. But he had to prove to America that he was the racial pioneer that people like Martin Luther King understood from the beginning.
Okay, so we've heard about Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. Tell us what you found out about Count Basie's shrouded and sordid history in the town of his birth, Red Bank, New Jersey, and how that shaped his personality.
So no offense to New Jersey or to Red Bank, but anybody who hasn't been to Red Bank, don't bother going, because the only thing worth knowing about Red Bank is that it was the home of Count Basie. And Count Basie couldn't wait to get the heck out of Red Bank. He initially thought he would get out by joining the circus. He ended up deciding that he had this skill at plunking the keyboard of a piano and that that was his ticket out of Red Bank. He learned in New York at the feet of the great Fats Waller. And he had this magical skill, better even than Louis Armstrong and that Duke Ellington, at putting his own ego aside and leading a band of extraordinary performers in a way that once you signed up with a Count Basie band, you never wanted to leave it. So it as good as Louis Armstrong was as a solo performer, and as good as Duke Ellington was as a composer, Count Basie maybe was the best band leader of all times. And the Count Basie Orchestra could make people not just tap their toes, but get up out of their seats and want to dance, because he knew how to swing.
Okay, and it's awesome. Okay, so the title of the book is The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America by Larry Tai. But what about Billie Holiday, Etta James, Nina Simone, jazz women? They had powerful stories that contributed mightily to creating a love for the music. Is that another book?
So that should be another book, and I'd love to write the book on the jazz women. The reason they weren't included in my book is that in the era where the Bessie Smiths, and even by the time Billie Holiday came along, there was not just racial bias, there was gender bias. And even by great jazz men like Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, these amazing women vocalists were dismissed as thrushes or canaries. And the chance for a woman to become a famous and successful instrumentalist, not to mention a band leader, it was three times as hard. And there was only one woman of their era who managed to defy all those expectations and become a great instrumentalist as a piano player and a great band leader. And that was a woman who probably nobody would recognize if I only use her first two names, which were Lillian Hardin. But if I say Lillian Hardin Armstrong, Louis Armstrong's second wife, people might recognize that she was the hot Lil on maybe the greatest jazz recordings ever, which were Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives. And those were amazing. Lil Hardin was amazing, and she defied racial and gender biases.
And, you know, finally, what stands out about your book, you have what amounts to a photo album of the jazzmen featured in your book, but some very interesting moments were captured. The one with the Count and Jesse Jackson and Dionne Warwick, the one with the Duke fleeing from a group of female fans, and one with Louis Armstrong smooching Lucille. And very briefly, we just have a minute left. Were those photos difficult to get?
Really difficult to get. And I tried to get photos that nobody had ever seen. And Those photos tell the story, not just of these jazz men, but of Jim Crow America and how these guys.
Okay, thank you, Larry. I'm sorry, we're gonna have to cut you off there. Larry Tye, New York best-selling author, former Boston Globe reporter, a Harvard University Nieman Fellow, and author of The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Thank you so much, Larry, for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week's What's at Stake. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Masella. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with E. Faye Williams. And in the words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spyro Gyral celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th, and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
Are you passionate about eradicating air pollution? Would you like to participate in the Environmental Justice Artivist Fellows Transformative Community Art Project in Ward 5, Washington, D.C.? We're seeking Ward 5 professional and amateur photographer portraits that capture the theme of what clean air in Ward 5 should be. Selected submissions will be featured in the Up in the Air mural design, which will be installed in a prominent Ward 5 location in fall 2024. Submission is free. The deadline is next Saturday, September 14th. Submissions can be made at socialartandculture.info.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details and how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Thank you.
talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening